You may have seen some of those rather extraordinary images of British bankers being very publicly grilled by a government select committee. A lot of this was on UK TV. The former lions of the banking system apologising profusely to the UK public. It was a scene to make the great economist John Maynard Keynes roll in his grave. Since the 70s, Keynesian economics has been replaced by free market liberalism. But with America's crisis sending us all into a spin, his name and his ideas are well and truly back in favour. And according to my next guest, John Maynard Keynes is definitely a thinker for these times. Lord Robert Skidelsky has written a classic three-volume biography of John Maynard Keynes. He's also a former Conservative politician, and he's the Emeritus Professor of Political Economy at the University of Warwick. A short time ago, I welcomed Lord Skidelsky to Saturday Extra.
Well, good evening here.
Good evening to you, precisely. Would Keynes be saying "I told you so" if he was here now?
I think he would. Yes, I think he thought that these sort of shocks and crises were inherent in the market economy, and if governments were foolish enough to allow them to develop, then they would happen. And so he wouldn't have been surprised. What he would have been surprised about was the idea that markets were so stable that things like this could never happen, which was really the orthodox theory of the day, in his day. And it seems to have been the theory of the recent past.
Yes, he's remembered as an economist, of course, with his general theory of money, but he was a reluctant economist. In fact, you say he was the most brilliant non-economist who ever applied himself to economics, and this is both an asset and a problem.
Yes, well, I think economics wasn't his first love. He once wrote that he hoped that one day economists would become as useful as dentists, which didn't imply a very high rating. I think his first love was really philosophy, and also the arts. He did turn to economics, but I wonder whether he would have become a very serious economist had it not been for the shocks of the First World War and the crises of the 1920s that really drove him to economics seriously.
I want to come to that because his prescriptions were as much about alleviating social problems as economic problems, and I just don't think that's necessarily stressed enough. But just get to this issue of employment, which was a key of what you call the Keynesian revolution. He wanted to find a monetary economy that was capable of influencing the quantity of employment and not merely its direction. And this is the key to understanding him. Could you explain that, please?
Well, I think at that time, I think economics was dominated enormously by what I'd call a scarcity perspective, which was that resources could never be underemployed because wants were always pressing on them. And he sort of understood that one was living in a different era, which was more of an era of abundance. It wasn't that scarcity was gone, but an era in which you could actually, for long periods, have a large amount of unemployed resources. And economics didn't have any explanation of how this could be. He was, of course, living in England in the 1920s when unemployment was never less than 10% of the insured workforce. And so you had this sort of somehow unemployment in the midst of poverty. And he wanted to explain that paradox, and he found it in the working of a monetary economy. In a monetary economy, people didn't always have to spend what they earned; they could hoard it.
So money was a store of value. I think you've got this lovely phrase: people held money as a way of postponing transactions. And I'm extrapolating wildly from what you're saying, but it's almost as if you're saying this was the great transition point from that sort of assumption that people were locked into hierarchies, that they, by actually taking charge of their own lives, they could create surpluses in their own lives, and therefore settle. And I presume in a way, you know, that's the transition to a sort of middle-class life, that you feel you are not in thrall to everyone else, the way the sort of great working-class predicament.
I'm not sure I would put it in exactly that way, but I know exactly what you're saying, and it's not far away from what I'd say. It was that really people were liberated more from the grinding pressure of poverty and the external necessity. It was just because societies were getting wealthier, and I think therefore they didn't feel that they had to. That anything they earned, they had to spend or they'd starve.
We're listening to Robert Skidelsky, Lord Robert Skidelsky, who is the acclaimed biographer of John Maynard Keynes, and we're talking about really trying to get to the bottom of what Keynes really does mean. Could I just cut across you there? Because I'm really interested in this, his obsession with the politics of all of this that is not discussed enough, I don't think. He had a real concern that you couldn't take the risk of societies just having a vacuum in their midst and sliding into depression. What was it that motivated him there?
I think he believed that there would be a slide. He didn't believe that markets were self-correcting, or at any rate correcting in any time frame that you could feel safe with. And remember, this was the late 1920s, early 1930s. And as a result of the Great Depression, direct result of the Great Depression, Hitler came to power in Germany. And in a way, there was a great political danger in allowing economies to slide deep into depression on the mistaken theory that they would soon recover. He believed that there was no natural self-recovering force, or if there was, it would be rather weak and would take a long, long time. And people are saying this today, even with all the stimulus measures and the that have been adopted, that this recession will last quite a long time, well into 2010.
That was his idea, that ultimately, to cut to the chase, that if governments therefore had to do the spending that needed to be done if no one else would. Governments had to do it in order to, in effect, save their communities from unravelling.
Yeah, save their communities from unravelling, save democracy against the assaults of extremists. Democracies can, of course, have new deals. They don't have to be paralysed in the face of large-scale economic collapses.
Mm. There's another interesting area here that you've quoted in some of your subsequent writing, which is, as you say, the terrain of Karl Marx, a long tradition, recently revived, which argued that the more unequal the distribution of income, the more unstable an economy will be. Do you look at this most recent crisis that we're in, prompted from within, no external forces, as you say, the system itself prompted this problem, and actually see Marx's predictions coming true?
Undoubtedly, the more equal incomes are in a society, I think the more stable it will tend to be economically, leave aside socially, which I think is also true. This is certainly something that Keynes believed as well. It's just that if society is too unequal in its income distribution, Keynes actually thought that it would then save too much, and that you would have too high a propensity to save in relation to investment opportunities. I don't think
that wasn't a correct diagnosis, was it?
It wasn't a correct diagnosis. I think you have to look at it a different way, which is that if you have incomes which are stagnant in relation to expectations, and they have been recently, globalization has made income inequality much great, then in order to keep up with the standard of living that they're expected to, there'll be a much greater tendency for people to get into debt. And I think that the housing bubble, which burst in the United States, was a debt bubble. It was a debt-financed bubble. It's also that people have not been getting any substantial increase in their real incomes.
Yes, but there's another conundrum here. That one of the things he wrote, I think, was that what is rational for individuals can be catastrophic for economies. And this is really tricky, isn't it? Because we're living in an age of individualism. That's been one of the real features of our recent times, the individual versus over the group, as it were. Did his theories take account? He was writing in a very different time.
He was, but he didn't think that individualism was necessarily the be-all and end-all of social life. He thought that community was very, very important. And he thought that if everything was placed on individual choice and individual preference without taking into account other social values, you see, for the economist, individualism is really just self-enrichment. And Keynes didn't believe that that was necessarily something that was going to produce the good life. He didn't believe it made up a good society necessarily.
Final question, in a way. Would it be fair to say, though, I mean, his theories really, I suppose, prevailed in that great post-war boom, and then with the rise of Reaganism, Milton Friedman and the neoliberal thoughts, Maggie Thatcher and so on, they were laid aside and he became really quite criticised. But would it be fair to say that for quite a while in our recent times, lightly regulated or unregulated market economies were pretty stable, and they in fact created a great deal of wealth for a lot of people who otherwise wouldn't have tilted at it? And it was actually, if you go back, was the removal of the Glass-Steagall Act in 1999 in the United States, which separated what banks could do. Commercial banks couldn't be investment banks. And it was the removal of that after a $300 million campaign by business interests, certain business interests, to remove it, that it was only then, really, that things went seriously awry.
Yeah, that was the big thing that released finance from its previous constraints, and banks became, as someone's put it, public utilities with casinos attached to them. I think that the release of finance from regulation, the banking system from regulation, undoubtedly promoted and accelerated the development of the financial instruments, which and terrifically accelerated securitization, which enabled the debt culture, enabled a huge pyramid of debt to be built. Inverted pyramid of debt to be built on a very narrow base of assets. And I think the repeal of Glass-Steagall, as you rightly said, helped that come about. Mm. And I think we've got to get back to something like Glass-Steagall type of banking, in which banks become much narrower in what they do, and the investment function, they don't become investment vehicles.
No, I'm just saying in other words, even though that wasn't just a Keynesian, that wasn't to do with Keynes, no. Though, was it? I mean, in other words, for many years, it may have operated well enough, despite what Keynes said, and it was that act change. Did that have anything to do with Keynesian theory? Did he say that you inevitably lead to something, a basic mistake like that?
I think Keynes, in the early 30s, Keynes was mainly interested in recovery and not reform. And he said reform has to come later. And I think he didn't, on the whole, pay much attention to institutions, except when he constructed the Bretton Woods system. He thought it could mainly be done by counter-cyclical policy. And that provided counter-cyclical policy was in place, then economies would remain stable and they would grow well. All I'm saying is that he didn't have a solution to every conceivable problem that might arise as a result of financial crises or during the course of financial crises. He dealt with the problems of his own time. But the basic idea that economies were unstable, that they lacked a self-correcting mechanism, and that if you allowed slides to develop, you could have very, very serious and dangerous political consequences, and therefore democracies had to do something to stop these catastrophes. Those central ideas are just as relevant today as they were when he propounded them.
Quite. Thank you very much indeed, Robert Skidelsky, for that terrific overview, and I think we'll all head back and start reading your books once more.
Well, there's a new one coming out, Keynes for Today.
Keynes for Today. When's that coming out?
Well, in a few months. It's actually called Keynes, the Return of the Maestro. It's a short one, but focus very much on what's going on at the moment.
Terrific. We shall look out for it. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
Goodbye.
And Robert Skidelsky's original classic was John Maynard Keynes, 1883 to 1946, economist, philosopher, statesman. It's a Macmillan publication, 1983. And I might add, he's written in yesterday's Financial Review's essay section a nice summary too, if Keynes Mark II, if you want to have a look at that. And do, you know, just bombard us with comments on whether you think it's still appropriate for our times. 18 to 9 and time for the weather around the country. Sydney will be 20 degrees with rain periods. Today, Brisbane 26, rain periods easing late. Perth 35, thundery shower or two easing. Adelaide 29, fine and mostly sunny. Hobart 21 degrees and fine. Canberra 20 and a possible shower and cloudy. Darwin 31, showers and afternoon storms. Wollongong, rain periods and a maximum of 20. Newcastle, rain periods, windy with a maximum of 21. And Melbourne, 28 degrees and smoke, which seems a perfect time to just to remind you of the Red Cross bushfire appeal number. You can call 1800 811 700. 1800 811 700. But if you heard Michael Raper last night on the ABC One show after the bushfires, the website is really the thing that they prefer people to use, which is www.redcross.org.au. www.redcross.org.au.